time.
Mystification. You can find a place at the table somewhere.
It's tight.
It is. But no. Everybody has a place at the table. That's a fundamental principle of democratic egalitarianism. Mystification. The concept of mystification is not that commonly used. It's not the standard off-the-shelf term in discussions of ideology. There should be plenty of...
They got stuck over there.
Somewhere the... there are plenty of copies. Where do they end up? Does everybody? I made like 25 copies.
Where did it stop? Obviously, I'll start this corner.
Wait. Oh, there's. I didn't. Here's two more. How many people don't have them? Okay, we can solve the problem. All right. It's not a standard term. In the Marxian discussions, and we'll discuss fetishism in a short while, fetishism is a common term, commodity fetishism, other kinds of fetishism. Legitimation, which we'll be discussing on Monday, is a very common term in discussions of ideology. Hegemony also. Mystification is not such a standard term. I think it should actually be elevated. I think it's at the very core of what's in play in the explanatory purposes for which ideology is used. It needs to be paired with another concept, which is perhaps even less used, demystification. So each of these terms in the conceptual space of ideology has a pair: legitimation, delegitimation, hegemony, counter-hegemony, mystification, demystification. And indeed, I think, the pivotal problem for a Marxian theory of ideology, probably the most important single component, is actually the theory of demystification. And the way to think about the way ideology works, as I will say towards the end of this lecture, is to theorize the obstacles to demystification, rather than to just see the process of mystification. The problem is, how do you overcome the obstacles to demystification? That's, I think, where the core of the institutional problem is, and what's at the core of what could be called ideological struggle. Ideological struggles are struggles over demystification, and they confront barriers, problems that have to be overcome. Yeah?
Is the term disillusionment ever used in the same way as demystification?
Now, Well, yeah, I mean, that could be, disillusionment has to, it suggests more the emotional connection to the ideas that you held. Your disillusion means you're discouraged, you no longer feel the loyalty to something. So it would have to do, disillusionment has more to do with delegitimation, I think, than with demystification. So remember the from the Terborn framework, there were these three modes of subjection and qualification, and three interpolations, to use the bizarre Althusserian term, which Terborn described as answers to the question, what exists, what is good, and what is possible. Legitimation is bound up with the question, what is good? A legitimate system is affirming some positive values. To say that a system is legitimate means that when you ask the question, what is good, you see that the system satisfies a set of criteria. Demystification is bound up above all with what exists and with what is possible. There can be mystifications on both of those. It's a little less relevant to the what is good. You can talk about the mystification of values, but that's not the main focus of problems of mystifications. It's claims about what exists and what is possible can be distorted and mystified in various ways. Hegemony has as its core anchor, I think, the what is possible, but it kind of combines all three. Hegemony is a problem of ideology that centers around how all three of these get connected. As we'll see when we discuss hegemony on ideological hegemony on Monday. So today we're talking about mystification. The problem of mystification is posed because of what could be thought of as the core puzzle in a Marxist account of subjectivity and of social reproduction. The core puzzle is this. If our diagnosis of capitalism and the massive harms it produces is correct, you know, if we have a good, scientifically adequate critique and diagnosis of the existing world, we believe that we live in a structure of social relations that imposes huge harms on people. And furthermore, harms that also have the character of being unjust because the harms are so unevenly distributed. And yet, lots and lots of people think this is okay. They think capitalism is the best possible system. They may have gripes about it. They may feel life isn't going so well. But masses of people who are harmed by a structure of social relations nevertheless endorse them normatively. That's the legitimation problem. But also don't see them as a problem. Now, there's the puzzle. You know, why do people see the world in such a way that the sources of things which harm them, they don't see them as harming? Mystification is an answer to that question. Why do people see the system as benign? It's because they have crappy views. They have incorrect understandings. They don't get it. Their beliefs about the system are distorted. And then the question is why? What are the mechanisms that explain why their beliefs are distorted? The simplest of all answers to that question is it's just inculcated. They've been subjected to propaganda from birth. They've been just pummeled with messages. They have all these incorrect views of the world, mainly because they've been told that this is how the world is. So that's probably the dominant view. Dominant in the sense of the most commonly encountered view. The main reason, the main explanation for why people hold such distorted views of the world in which they live is because that's what they've been told. You can call that the propaganda or the socialization view. Now, Marx had a... It's not that Marx rejected that. Certainly when Marx has had quips like the ruling ideas of an epoch are the ideas of the ruling class, you know, little slogans of that sort, that's suggesting that there are ideas of powerful people that rule, and the idea is that they're disseminated through the use of their power. That's the inculcation model, basically. And certainly there's some truth in that. One can hardly look at Fox News and not imagine that part of the reason why people hold certain views of the world is because they are constantly told those views. But the Marxist tradition has also embodied another element of the argument, that there are things about the mundane operation of this world which encourages, which supports, which reinforces all of these ideas, so that the ideas that people are told and which they come to believe, it's not just indoctrination. It's indoctrination against a background context where those ideas resonate in some way or other. They somehow or other conform to something about lived experience so that they aren't easily shaken. Commodity fetishism is one way that Marx talked about that. So commodity fetishism is an account of how certain aspects of subjectivity get generated by the direct lived experience of producing in a world where value is realized through commodities, not through the direct production for need. We'll again get to that later. So that isn't, it's not that commodity production was designed in order to produce fetishism. There's no suggestion that some clever ruling class elite said, now how can we get people to believe these things? Aha, we have to create commodity production in order to produce these illusions. No, it's that these illusions get generated by the practices in a mundane way of engaging in commodity production. Again, we'll get to fetishism in a moment. I think the concept of mystification is a good way of grappling with this set of issues. So let me give you a first, give you my definition of mystification. So the encapsulated definition, which is also given in the notes, is mystification are distortions of perceptions of reality that mask or obscure that reality. So they're not just distortions. They're distortions which have the effect of obscuring the reality. There are all sorts of distortions which don't have that effect. A simple example would be when you take a straight stick and push it into water at an angle, it looks bent because the angles of refraction of air and water are different. Now, nobody that sees that thinks, oh my God, the stick has been bent. Even if you don't understand how light works, you know, you don't have a good theory. You don't remember your high school physics, and you don't remember the reason why, when you look at the stick poking into water at an angle, it looks bent. You know that there's something or other going on there that has to do with what happens when light goes through water compared to air. And that was true for hunters and gatherers 20,000 years ago. I don't believe that there's ever been a culture in which people had as part of their views and their ideologies of nature, that is how they subjectively came to understand and believe the way nature worked, that when you put a stick into water, it bent, and when you pulled it out, it unbent. And nobody had that theory about how the world was, that it actually bends when you put it into water. They felt, they may not have understood why, but that there was just something about water that made it look bent. Now, what that means is that there was a distortion of perception. You know, it clearly looks bent, but it didn't obscure the reality. It didn't have the effect of confusing a person's cognitive understanding of the shape of that stick, even though it affected your perception. There's another important example in nature, however, which massively obscured reality, and that's the idea that the sun sets. People were burned at the stake at a certain point in the history of Western civilization for rejecting the direct perception. So you sit on a hillside. You know, you've all done it. Everybody has watched a sunset. Some of you may have attempted to imagine that the horizon is moving up to the sun, right? Because that's what's actually happening, is the horizon is moving up, the sun isn't moving down. You could kind of almost make it happen if you really will it, if you just kind of focus at the sun and just see if you can get the horizon to move. It doesn't really work. No matter how hard you try, because of the spatial and scalar relationship between the size of the Earth, the distance to the sun, the rotation of etc., our perceptual apparatus makes the sun plummet into the sea rather than the sea rise up to the sun. Well, throughout human history until a few hundred years ago, people everywhere, in every culture, imagined that the sun went around the Earth. It's the natural way to see it. It's the direct relationship between a cognitive structure, what's the relative movement of these two bodies, and your perception. Then Copernicus comes along and Galileo, and they look at the heavens and they think about all this stuff and they say, no, the only way to make sense of the movement of everything we see, the motion of the planets in the sky compared to the stars, looking at the sun, see the moon, the only way to really make sense of all this is to imagine that the Earth moves around the sun and rotates on its own axis, and it's round. Now, that's a scientific theory that makes sense of a lot of observations, and it has this wonderful property of also explaining why it looks like the sun sets. So a good theory of this sort has this fantastic reflexive character. Astronomy is reflexive in the sense that it enables us to understand why we see the world the way it is, as well as how the world really is. It has to do both. To defeat the mystification, it has to do both. Now, that was a shattering idea in the ideological universe of late medieval, early modern Europe. It was upsetting to people to imagine that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. And people were burned at the stake for holding such beliefs. It was such a dangerous and threatening belief to the overall ideological configurations, the answers to the question what exists, what is good, and what is possible, that it led to murderous repression. I dare say that none of you have ever felt angst and anxiety and a sense that the universe was out of whack because of a disjuncture between your perception of the sun setting and your knowledge that the Earth rotates. It's just a kind of curious thing. Indeed, if anything, it's a mild form of pleasure, of kind of intellectual and aesthetic pleasure, to know that we live on this big planet that's a small speck in the cosmos, and it rotates and it looks like the sun sets. If anything, you know, there's a kind of relaxed pleasure in the fact that we know that and that we can comfortably have our perceptions be different from our cognition without that being disruptive. The way I would describe it is what Copernicus and Galileo accomplished was a demystification of the celestial spheres. Now, it doesn't mean that the perceptions cease to be distorted any more than with the stick in the water, right? You can't make the stick look straight when it goes into the water. It looks bent because of the angles of refraction of water and air. That's the way our perceptual apparatus and our cognition works. You can't make it look like the horizon moves up to the sun. But it no longer, that distorted perception no longer masks the underlying reality. And that's because of the intervention of scientific understandings. That's also one of the reasons why I think science and the knowledge it produces cannot be just viewed as pure ideology. You know, this is a kind of rejection of the postmodernist discourse-centered view that all knowledge is constituted interior to discourses. It's not just a constitution interior to discourse, even though it is a discourse, but it's not just a discourse. The claim that the Earth rotates on its axis. And the view that that is better from the point of view of knowledge, from the point of view of our understanding of our relationship to the physical spaces in which we inhabit, that this is an improvement over the other view, and the other view is wrong, not just different, I think is fully justified. At one point, it was a huge challenge for people to accept this disjuncture between perception, immediate perception, and underlying structure. It no longer is a challenge at all. Ironically, you know, sort of even to fundamentalists who reject Darwinian evolution, the relative motion and position of the planets and Darwinian evolution have basically the same scientific status. There's as much evidence for one as for the other. You know, they're both equally established scientific understandings relative to their pre-scientific alternatives. Not necessarily relative to some future scientific improvement, who knows, but relative to any pre-scientific. I doubt if there are very many creationists who actually believe the world is flat and the Earth is the center of the universe and the sun rotates, revolves around it. Now, there may be a few, but most have rejected those aspects of biblical teaching. teaching. Mystification is distortions that mask reality. In ideologies of nature, the masking of reality by the distortions of perception were massive. And they were backed by apparatuses. So the reason why people were burned at the stake was not because the masses of ordinary people were so incensed that Copernicus and his followers could suggest that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. No, it was that the church hierarchy felt this was a challenge and a threat to their authority. And they organized the Inquisition. The Inquisition came later over Protestantism, but they organized the repression of such scientific beliefs. It was therefore ideological apparatuses and the power centers that controlled those apparatuses that got triggered to block the demystification. And a lot of the intellectual and cultural struggle in the early modern period was to break the power of the ideological repression of demystification of ideologies of nature. And so I think that's the way to think. And the problem was that those apparatuses were very powerful. And they undoubtedly delayed the generalization and spread of the Copernican Revolution and the Galilean additions to it. They retarded the spread of those ideas for, a century probably, something like that. Those of you who have done history of science probably know the actual speed of dissemination among intellectuals and elites of those ideas and how long it took for them to become generally accepted. I would say in the absence of those obstacles, which are built into apparatuses, controlled by real people making decisions to burn people at the stakes, in the absence of those apparatuses, the Galilean Revolution would have happened extremely rapidly. It was such a compelling and simple idea, basically, once it's explained. And ordinary people could understand that. It's not that they were just so mired in misbelief that they would refuse to hear it. Some would, just like some creationists continue to exist. But most people didn't take, throughout history, most people don't take religion as seriously as the enforcers of religion do. And the ideas would have spread very rapidly in the absence of institutionalized obstacles that block them by repression. Okay, that's mystification of nature. Now, we're interested in mystification of social relations, not mystification of nature. But I think the same basic way you should think about it. There are things, there are practices. Ordinary experiences are lived experience encountering the social world, which produce distortions, which could be easily demystified, or if not easily, at least could be demystified, but there are obstacles to the demystification. The ordinary experiences, though, provide the perceptual grounding for the robust mystifications. Let me just give a couple of examples. When we we'll give more examples of these, at least some of these, when we in the final lecture we talk about micro foundations of ideology. So here's some simple examples. First, individualistic explanations for individual acts of different sorts. Consider, for example, poverty. We observe that there are lots of poor people, even in a rich society. We observe that some people are poor and some people are not poor. That's just direct observation of the world. That observation that some people live in palaces and some people live in hovels, some people are homeless in the United States, some people have well-paying jobs, that's an observation which is a robust one. Nobody denies it. And everybody acknowledges that. It's a direct observation. We also observe that some people who are born poor become well off and some do not. Indeed, there are plenty of examples of a family that's born, a poor family with five children, and one or two of them end up getting university degrees and good jobs, and the others remain poor. So we observe that there's variations across people in how well off they are, and that that variation occurs even when you informally control for their class origins. So two people in the same socioeconomic condition end up with different fates. The cause of these outcomes must have something to do with the differences between the people. Why are some people poor and some people not poor? It must be obvious that it's because there's some difference between people who are poor and people who are not. The explanation of poverty then becomes collapsed into explanations for why some people are poor and others not. The structural basis for the existence of poverty as such, exploitation, class, capitalism, etc., is opaque and obscured because of the direct perception that there's different attributes of people who you see are poor compared to the attributes of people who you directly see are not poor. An example which I sometimes give is the following, because this makes the point completely transparently. Imagine you have a class in which you have a completely malevolent professor who has set up, unbeknownst to anybody, a grading system which allows only one person in the class to get an A. So it's a severe curve. One A, two B's, everybody else gets C's or less. And we see at the end of the class that Mary got an A. And we ask, why did Mary get an A? And we look and we see she's brilliant and she just worked her butt off the whole semester. And we say, see, hard work explains why Mary got an A. Right? And why John didn't. Not realizing that there's some causal process completely independent of the behavior of anyone that explains why there was only one A to be got. Now, the collapsing of the problem of why somebody gets an A and ignoring the question, why is there only one A to be had, the ignoring of that second question is exactly what happens when people try to explain poverty on the basis of the lack of human capital. A person is poor because they're uneducated. Well, that's only true if you ignore why it is that people who are uneducated live in a world in which the consequence of that is to become poor, and why it is that there is an underlying structure that generates a structure of opportunities, which limits the number of opportunities for well-paying and advantageous jobs. The latter is a more complicated kind of argument. It's a bit like understanding how the relationships of the planets and the sun and the earth are. It's more complicated because it requires you to step back from the immediate, directly observable phenomena, which are people and their fates, to understanding how the whole system of people and places work. Crime is another example. I mean, if there's any activity which is directly tied to a behavior, I mean, forgetting the issue of whether the police plant evidence and accuse the wrong people. Let's ignore that kind of. That's an additional complication, which is not relevant to the point here. People who rob banks, rob banks. That's what they do. You know, why do, who was it? It's a famous story of a bank robber who was asked, why do you rob banks? And his answer was, that's where the money is. People rob banks, and they made a decision. You don't just by accident rob a bank. You make a decision. Oh, yes, today we're going out and we're going to rob a bank. You prepare for it. You do stuff to do it. And not everybody does it. You can have two brothers living in exactly the same situation. One robs a bank, one doesn't rob a bank. It's kind of natural to explain the reason why one brother robs a bank and the other not as being something to do with the difference between the two brothers. That since it is a deliberate choice by a person to engage in that behavior, you're spontaneously, I think, and I think this is probably, and when I say spontaneously, I mean it, that it's probably something that we're hardwired for. It's probably part of our neuropsychology. That when you observe a difference between two similar things and you're trying to explain different choices, you probably explain it by way of looking at the attributes. That's a kind of pre-scientific, spontaneous form of cognition. And I suspect it's true in hunter and gatherer societies as well. You know, you have a hunter-gatherer society and you have one person who's a slacker and another person who isn't, and there will be slackers in hunter-gatherer societies, and people will get annoyed at the slacker, and they'll assume that it's some attribute of the slacker that makes them a slacker. Now, it may be that they believe that the slacker is infested with a evil spirit. You know, the actual explanation of the flawed attribute may be different from the way we would do it, but still, explaining differences between the behavior of persons on the basis of differences between the attributes of person, I think, is probably a spontaneous causal attribution, explanatory move that we make as Homo sapiens. Probably cognitively universal. You know, that would be my guess. And therefore, it's rather like seeing the sun setting, which is a spontaneous, universal consequence of our cognitive machinery given the spatial properties of nature. And again, what this obscures is a whole range of aspects of criminality which have absolutely nothing to do with the attributes of persons. It has to do with, for example, the opportunities that people in different social structural positions face. Why don't poor people embezzle millions of dollars from banks? Why don't they engage in insider trading? It's so much more lucrative than mugging. Duh. You know, the vast amount of property crime in the United States is committed by rich people. You know, orders of magnitude, more money is stolen by rich people than poor people. You know, by factors of hundreds. In total, I'm not saying per crime, I'm saying in total. I mean, there's been estimates of the total amount of theft by people in the bottom 20% of income distribution compared to the top 1%, and the total amount of theft, not per capita amount, but the total amount, is orders of magnitude more in the top. Well, the answer to that is obvious. Why would a person in the top 1% mug somebody in the street? What a stupid way of getting extra pocket change. Why doesn't an unemployed ghetto African-American engage in derivative fraud? So we know the answers to those questions once they are asked. There are other, even more subtle questions, which we may know because we've studied these things, but which has to do with the fact that you live in a competitive capitalist society in which public goods are underdeveloped and the social wage is minimal, and the way in which people who are structurally marginalized from that system can manage to forge their way of life is by acting illegally with respect to certain aspects of the system. You know, that's a diagnosis that's even more social structural rather than just the opportunity structure of different sorts of people. My whole point here then is this. Individualistic explanations of individual acts are spontaneous. They don't require a lot of ideological propaganda to get people to believe that there's something different between criminals and non-criminals. What would take theoretical and scientific work is to explain why that's just a symptom of a broader set of causal processes which aren't just lodged in the attributes of persons. Social structural explanations of individual acts are like astronomy with respect to the movement of the Earth. And that requires theoretical work. And then the question is, what obstructs that from being understood? Another kind of mystification can be thought of as partial structural explanations of structural effects. So the first one was individualistic explanations of individual acts. This is partial structural explanations, incomplete and incomplete in crucial ways, structural explanations of structural effects. Because after all, lots of people do, at least in the contemporary world, give social explanations for social problems. They don't just give individualistic ones, but they're often extremely incomplete. A good example would be in the 19th century when workers were being displaced by machines in weaving, and a social movement arose, the Luddite movement, where workers smashed machines. And they blamed their fate on the machines. The problem they saw was that these big power-driven machines were destroying their ability to be weavers with hand-driven looms. And the enemy was the technology. Now, that's a partial social explanation that's incomplete in crucial ways. The problem wasn't the technology. The problem was the property relations under which the technology was deployed. If the weavers had owned the power-driven looms, you know, if they could have all collectively snapped their collective fingers and replaced their hand looms with power looms and had full property rights in them, what they would have been able to do would have been to drastically reduce the length of their working day and produce the same amount of output, or produce vastly more output and keep working more or less as hard as they were and become vastly richer than they had been. The problem was that the property rights in those machines were vested in a different class of people. And that's what had the result of the machines not merely replacing the looms, but replacing the workers. And that's a much more complicated explanation. The direct, immediately perceived explanation that it's the machines that are causing the problem is what I'm referring to as a partial structural explanation. Instead of mechanization releasing time from toil for all people, it releases some people from their jobs altogether. The same issue as concerns automation in the present period. When an auto factory becomes automated and robots replace the hand-operated production line, that should be celebrated by workers because it's not much of a life to work on a classic Fordist assembly line. It's a crummy kind of job, daily repetitive motions. Automating that and have robots do it is a huge improvement in the human condition with respect to the kinds of things you can produce that way. The problem is that the machines replace people. They don't just reduce toil. But imagine if all the workers in General Motors or in Toyota were full owners of the factory. There were 10,000 employees working, you know, 40 hours a week, and now they get all these robots, and it only requires 1,000 people to work 40 hours a week, or 10,000 people to work 4 hours a week. Well, if they were all collectively the owners, which would they choose? Would they choose to force out into unemployment 9,000 workers and have the remaining 1,000 work 40 hours a week? No, if they were all the joint collective owners of the robots now, they would say, my God, we can have a really short work week and do all sorts of other stuff. I mean, they wouldn't necessarily decide they were only going to work 4 hours a week. They might decide to start engaging in other kinds of productive activity as well. So the point is, it's the property rights which explain why the machine displaces persons. But that's not transparent. Right? See, that's what's immediately given in the direct lived experience is that the robot meant I lost my job. So to go back to the general idea of ideology, remember when we talked about ideology as a form of practice, ideological practice, what does it do? It transforms lived experience into a set of cognitive beliefs. So the raw material is lived experience. What ideology does is transform lived experience into a set of cognitive beliefs. What is obstructed then in the process of mystification is a set of ideological practices which would transform the lived experience of being displaced by a robot into the cognitive beliefs that this is due to the property relations within which the robots are owned, rather than to the machines themselves. And that's the problem then of demystification rather than demystification. Yeah.
So many people here know my brother's a libertarian, and I'm reading an economy book that he recommended to me, and the chapter that I actually just read was on technology, and the argument that the author put forward was that that technology actually ends up expanding production in many of these industries, like the cloth industry and the automobile industry. And so it's not that some workers are displaced initially, but that in the end, the industry actually ends up being much more productive, and so more people are kind of taken back into the industry.
The latter is a non sequitur. That is, it can be end up being much more productive, and sometimes they might bring people back and sometimes not. I mean, there's no inherent reason why, because it expands, that it brings back the people that were displaced. At a minimum, there's huge human suffering generated by this displacement, because it's different people that get brought in. What typically happens when you have a major technological transformation of a sector is its productivity goes up, a lot of workers lose their job. As the industry expands and new workers are hired, it's younger workers. It's new cohorts of workers that are brought into the new technology, and the old cohorts are just on the refuse heap. So it's an incorrect description about the actual people. And it's an entirely contingent description as to whether the net effect is or is not increased employment. In agriculture, it's massively decreased employment. It used to be that 50-60% of the labor force produced in agriculture, now it's 1.5%. It's not the case that the increasing productivity in agriculture has led to, even in the long run, an expansion of employment in agriculture. It hasn't. It's led to this massive reduction of employment in agriculture. And whether or not there are other sectors that are going to increase the productivity and jobs in ways that provide good standards of living for people is entirely contingent. There's nothing in capitalism that generates that. Capitalists have no incentive whatsoever to create good-paying jobs for people. They only have incentives to expand employment dependent upon what the technological capacities are. So there was this brief period where that story had some plausibility. It certainly doesn't seem to have it now. I mean, the evidence is not very strong that the workers who have been displaced by the destruction of American industry are finding, good, well-paying jobs in alternative expanding sectors.
It also seems to me when I was reading the chapter that another response would perhaps be that machines lowered the overall skill level required for the job, because instead of having to know how to make a shoe, you have to know how to press a button and pull a lever so that the shoe is made, which then cheapens the labor so that you don't have to pay them as much.
Well, again, a lot of things, a lot of these things just depend upon the details of specific situations. So the move to full robotization means that the remaining jobs often are very highly skilled. You need maintenance people, for example, for robots. There is not yet meta-robots. That is, we don't yet have robotic systems in which you fully automate the repair of the robots, and that the robots that fix the robots are themselves fixed by robots. So the repair and maintenance functions within these highly complex machines is a very skilled position, because it requires lots of problem solving under very variable conditions. Things break down in so many different ways. So it's true that if you think of it then as we've replaced 5,000 assembly line workers with a couple of hundred maintenance workers, the average skill level of that production process has gone up. But the 1,000 assembly workers who have been displaced may now be, in flipping hamburgers or whatever, or just unemployed. There's no inherent reason why the de-skilling process for the jobs that remain will be more higher or less than the reskilling process. That is contingent just on the nature of the technology. Generally speaking, The average skill level in automated systems is higher than in non-automated systems, but there's just many fewer people doing it. But the average skills of those who are working are higher, not lower. That was different in the Industrial Revolution when the transition was from skilled artisanal work to assembly line work. Right, so that was a massive de-skilling process. But the transition from Fordist assembly line work to post-Fordist, flexible, robotically driven, integrated, computer-regulated systems has led to a massive shedding of labor, but to an upskilling problem, my guess is, overall, an upskilling of the remaining labor force. Okay. Those are social examples of mystification. I think they should be thought of in the same way as the mystification of nature. And the puzzle is why they're so robust. Why don't people come to understand that these are partial explanations and that individualistic explanations are superficial? Just as why didn't people come to understand that the Earth rotated on its axis? And I don't think the best explanation for why people adopt individualistic explanations of individual outcomes is mainly that that's all they've been told. I think that's an incomplete explanation of the phenomenon itself. It may be what they've been told, but that's reinforcing a process which is spontaneously given, and the key question then is why aren't they being told other things? Why aren't other understandings being given equal weight in order to demystify the distortions that are produced through lived experience? Now let's briefly discuss fetishism. Fetishism is a term that's has a very venerable tradition, location in the Marxist tradition, as a way of thinking about mystification. And the way I would like to frame it is that it's a particular form of mystification. And I actually think that it's probably not the most helpful way of understanding the general problem. It's not that it's not relevant, but I think that fetishism is a very specific aspect of mystification. The idea of a fetish, the general meaning of fetishism, is any process by which people attribute powers to something which it doesn't have. The kind of classical meaning of fetishism is that you have a physical object which people attribute powers. They infuse that physical object with powers that the object doesn't have. In religious contexts, you'll have a St. Christopher medal that you believe if you wear will protect you, or if you put it in. I guess that's for travelers, right? So taxis have St. Christopher medals sometimes hanging from the visor, the rearview mirror. If it's fetishized, what it means is the person actually has a belief that having that medal there will protect them, that it has the power to protect. A fetish is a physical object in anthropology, a totem of some sort, that is seen as actually embodying the spirit of whatever it represents. So if you need courage, you carry a bear fetish with you. I think a bear fair, or wolf, in certain Native American traditions, I think bear is courage, I'm not sure. And that carrying the fetish, because the fetish embodies the power of courage, will convey that courage to you. Now, of course, in the kind of psychological context of religion, as we know, believing that a bear fetish gives you courage may actually give you courage. It's like in the Dumbo cartoon, the Walt Disney cartoon, where Dumbo has, how many of you have seen the Dumbo cartoon? Yeah. Wonderful story. Dumbo has these huge ears. He's kind of ridiculed. His mouse friend, it's a mouse, right, his friend? I think it's a mouse. Anyway, it's a very small critter, his friend, who befriends him. He's shunned by all the other elephants because of these ridiculous ears. He thinks that Dumbo can fly. if he flaps his ears. And Dumbo doesn't believe it. And the mouse gives the gives Dumbo a magic feather, which he tells Dumbo, if you hold this feather and flap your ears, you'll be able to fly. And Dumbo believes it, flaps his ears and can fly, but then the feather, he loses the feather and he starts plummeting to earth. And the mouse has to convince Dumbo that he can fly anyway. Right? So that's an example where having the feather fetish actually did enable Dumbo to fly. There is a causal connection, but it works through the belief. The belief in the fetish is what gave Dumbo the courage to flap the ears and take the risk. So a bear fetish can give warriors the courage to go into battle and actually be courageous in ways that helps them win the battle. This is like the Trobriand Island example of the ritual before going into the deep sea, which gives the fishermen the courage to go into the deep sea, which they wouldn't have done in the absence of the ritual. So fetishes actually do have consequences for shaping the actions of people by virtue of the power of beliefs. But the attribution of it as a fetish is that it's a cognitively distorted, it's a cognitively incorrect attribution. The correct diagnosis is that this bear fetish doesn't actually embody the spirit of courage. It's only by virtue of the fact that I believe it does that it gives me power. But of course, the cognitively correct understanding of the power of the fetish destroys the power of the fetish. It no longer has the power to encourage my courage if I understand that that its power comes entirely from my psychological state. So that's a case where the causal structure that's set in motion by the fetishism requires the cognitive distortion in order for it to work. So it's a pretty interesting cluster of social processes and psychological processes that produce behavioral consequences. Well, that's the general idea of fetishism. Marx is deploying this idea in the context of trying to understand the nature of capitalism, and particularly the way in which people perceive the operation of capitalism. So it's an attempt to diagnose the subjective states of actors living in a world of capitalism. It's the first chapter of Volume 1 of Capital. Capital, the book, is a critique of political economy. The book is both an explication of how capitalism works and an explanation for why people don't see that that's the way capitalism works this way. So it's a critique of existing political economic theories and trying to explain why they have this distorted view. It's an effort at demystifying, if you will, the world of capitalism by criticizing the extant theories of capitalism. And part of the criticism of the extant theories of capitalism is to explain why they went wrong, where they made their mistakes in their own conceptual structure. It would be as if in the first chapter of Copernicus said, of course, it's important to understand that the reason why we see the sun setting is because we're tiny little creatures on a big planet. You know, and the scale and the relationship of these makes us see the sun as setting rather than the earth as rotating. That would be the demystifying moment, because that would be the part where you explain to the reader why they have this distorted perception. What Marx is doing in the commodity fetishism chapters is essentially explaining to the reader, many of whom, probably most of whom, will have already read Ricardo and Smith. They're already familiar with the basic canon of existing political economy. And he's saying, okay, reader, bear with me a little bit. I'm going to explain why everybody has this distorted view. And it's basically an effort to show how there's a misattribution of causal powers that comes from the way commodities are produced and operated and the way capital is produced and operated. I like Cohen's explication of this. I think he does a pretty good job of explaining where this misattribution of powers comes from. In the case of commodity fetishism, Cohen writes, it appears that people labor because their products have value, whereas in fact, the products have value because labor has been bestowed upon them. Commodities appear to have a power of their own, autonomous from the producers, but the power of commodities is entirely because of the activities of the producers. People generate value through their laboring activity that's embodied in commodities. That's what gives those commodities power. It's not that because commodities have power, people labor. Capital appears to have a power of its own independent of the condition of its conditions of existence. Since capital is necessary for means of production to be set in motion, it appears that capital itself is productive. But capital isn't productive, Marx says. Having a zillion dollars isn't productive. What's productive is having factories and means of production and labor working hard and cooperatively together to transform nature to produce new things. That's what's productive. The capital doesn't have productive power. Capital only has any power because under capitalism it's the necessary condition for means of production to be set in motion. This leads economists to see capital and labor as two factors of production, each of which receives their proper share of revenues. Capital gets its proper share of revenues, that's a return to its productivity, and workers receive their revenues, which are a return to their productivity. That's an incorrect allocation because it's a misattribution of power. That it's not that owning the means of production has any power, it's that the means of production have power. So those are two specific instances of mystification, the misattribution of powers to things that don't really have power, and it underwrites, in Marx's view, the basic structure of classical political economy and the mistakes it makes in diagnosing the source of profits and the dynamics of capitalism. Now, some writers in the Marxist tradition take that idea, I think mainly because they're Marxologists and want to use fetishism as the generic term for mystification. Whereas I think mystification is a much more useful and broader expression. It's a clearer way of understanding the full range of ways in which perceptions are distorted in ways that mask reality, and draws our attention to the problem of the obstacles for challenging such mystifications, and not eliminating the distortion, but eliminating the masking. All right, it's 5 after 11. I think we should take our break because all right, everybody. Point 4 on the outline: mystification and reality. This is probably redundant at this point, but it's just something worth emphasizing. Mystifications are not hallucinations. They're not hallucinations. They do represent real relationships. Poor people do have different characteristics from non-poor people. Criminals may have specific personality traits. Government spending may increase inflation. You know, mechanization does displace workers. So commodities do assume an autonomous power which dominates exchange. And capital does receive a profit proportional to its magnitude. So these aren't hallucinations. From the vantage point of the earth, the sun moves through the sky, etc. These are real effects. Mystification is in the distortion of the understanding of the character of these effects in ways which makes it, which cognitively masks the real relations. So this is just a really important thing to think about when you use this term when you think about these kinds of distortions. It's the task of a demystification process is not to deny the reality of the perception as such, but to provide the scientific understanding which enables someone to understand both why they perceive the world the way they do and why the world works in a particular way. That's why it's a double move, mystification. It's not a denial of the perception. It's an explanation of how the world works in a way that also explains why people perceive the world the way they do. If they were sheer hallucinations, you know, I mean, if it really was the case that people believe things that are completely false and have no resonance with lived experience, either it would mean there's a psychotic process going on. I mean, people do have hallucinations. Or if a person accepts evidence and argument, it would be relatively easy to dispel the false belief. It's the fact that it has resonance with lived experience that renders these distortions difficult to demystify. Point five, the contrast between mystification of the actual and mystification of the possible. This, I think, is, you know, I guess I have a habit of saying this is the most important, right? You know, this is the critical. I don't know if this is the most important point or not, but it's certainly a very important issue. That one of the consequences of mystification is that people fail to understand that the existing social world and its properties and structures and constraints are not inevitable or natural or eternal, but rather are the result of particular socially constructed ways of doing things. Capitalism is seen as the only form of social organization capable of organizing the production of use values, when capital is seen as this independent power that is the necessary condition for production. Capital is assigned a power it doesn't have. It's not the case that it's a natural power. That's the necessary condition for all production in a complex system. It's just the particular form of social relations that have been constructed within which, given those relations, it becomes a necessary condition for production to take place. This is, I think, of tremendous importance, because if people believe there's no other possibility, even if they feel the existing society is terrible and creates great hardship, there will be little incentive to try to transform it. This has come to be known as the TINA problem, T-I-N-A, there is no alternative. TINA is essentially the result of a naturalization of a socially constructed relationship. In the case of gender, this is one of the kind of fundamental points of the feminist critique of existing social relations, is to denaturalize the relations between men and women, to see, sometimes it's referred to as to de-essentialize them, to see the particular historically specific form of gender relations as not reflecting the essence of what it means to be a man and a woman, but a particularly socially constructed and socially changeable way of organizing social relations between men and women. Because I think this is such a central part of the whole mystification process, naturalizing socially constructed relations as if they were inevitable, this is why the demonstration of alternatives becomes such a crucial part of the struggle against ideology. It's not just that building alternatives in the world is an important part of actually changing the world. It's one of the ways you change the world is to build alternatives. Building alternatives is crucial as part of the demystification process of the inevitability of the present, the inevitability of what we observe. The building of alternatives can take many forms. Historically, the ambition of anti-capitalist was to build alternatives through revolutionary models, where you have a revolutionary break in a particular country, which demonstrates to the rest of the world that an alternative to capitalism is possible. Yeah.
I'm sorry, just really quick before you move to the revolution, I had a question about commodity art, capital and its relation to production. So basically what you're saying is that there's no incentive, there's no incentive to produce without the existence of some particular property that's assigned to it.
In capitalism, there's no incentive to allocate resources to production unless it's profitable to capital. So the key thing is, owners of capital need a return on their investment in order to activate systems of production. As opposed to a system which says, if there is a need in the society, that's what provides the spur, the motivation for allocating our collective resources to solve a problem. Now that, a needs-based allocation of resources to produce, is something that can't happen in a society where the resources are controlled by private owners. It's not enough to point out to private owners that there is some needs that need to be met to get them to allocate their resources. You have to also say, and you'll get a return on your investment. The question then is that because that's the natural order of things, or is it because simply of the power relations built into the structure of capitalism?
And then, so, for example, an argument to that posed by rational economists is that like efficient markets hypothesis and all these other things in rational economics say that it doesn't matter if it's true on the individual level that incentive like isn't the necessary predicate for production, but as long as most of the people most of the time like believe that that's the case, then that's the reality of like the of production.
But the efficient market hypothesis still presupposes that private individuals are the holders of the power to allocate resources, right? So that it's still private property, and it's still the power that comes from capital that is, that you have this mass of resources that you can allocate. It's a mass of capital in the sense that it's abstract, it's money, that you can then use to buy iron ore and machinery to produce steel or whatever. Whether the incentives are based on good information or just beliefs about returns, I mean, that's an additional question. The key thing is that it's not needs that drive the allocation of resources, it's returns to capital that drive. If that's seen as natural, then it's this mystification of the possible. So the additional point I wanted to make here is that demonstration models, practical on-the-ground models of alternatives, have a hugely important ideological role to play. Not just a practical role in solving problems, but an ideological role in demystifying the natural. This was absolutely central to the women's movement. It's how, in fact, certain aspects of the transformation of gender relations occurred. It's by people demonstrating that you could live good lives under alternative relations. And that becomes kind of the basis by which then people become attracted to live out these alternative models in their own lives. In the case of capitalism as a whole, the revolutionary ideal at the beginning of the 20th century was that by having some places in the world break with capitalism, this would inspire revolutionary transformations elsewhere, where inspire means it would demystify the sense of what's possible everywhere. It's one of the reasons why it became such an imperative from anti-revolutionary or counter-revolutionary forces to cripple revolutions, even if you couldn't defeat them. Perhaps the most transparent case of this is what happened in Cuba, where, you know, after the Cuban Revolution, a very conscious decision was made, if we can't overthrow it, we can at least cripple it so it's not such a good model. You know, we can make it a less attractive model. Noam Chomsky has made what many people think of as a kind of ironic argument about the Vietnam War. Most people think we lost the Vietnam War and that we won the war in Iraq. What Chomsky says is we won the war in Vietnam and have lost the war in Iraq. Now, how can you say that? We won the war in Vietnam because we made the Vietnamese model of a break with capitalism so unattractive and costly that it wasn't copied elsewhere. And 30 years later, Vietnam is firmly on the road to capitalism anyway and back integrated into the world capitalist system on the terms favorable to multinational capital. We won the war in Vietnam because other countries decided it was way too costly. The United States would just smash them to such, raise the cost so high that you just can't break out of the world capital system that way. We've lost the war in Iraq because although we toppled Saddam Hussein, we haven't successfully created a puppet regime that's stably part of our camp. And the future is extremely uncertain as to what that regime is going to be like and how it's going to re-articulate itself into the global capitalist system, since it never had as, it was never broken out. The issue in Iraq wasn't will it or will it not be part of global capitalism. Of course it will be. That's how it sells its oil. The issue is what will be its position in the geopolitics of capitalism, and that we've lost. We haven't been able to establish a client regime there, a stable client regime. So our war aims were different. We've lost the current one, although it looks like we won. And we won the Vietnam War, although it looked like we lost. Yeah, I mean, that's a bit playing with words, what win and lose means. But the basic point is with respect to what the war objectives were. Okay, I think Cuba is this terrific example because there are white papers from the CIA in the 1960s which explicitly say what we have to do is lower the standard of, do things that will lower the standard of living of people in Cuba so that it will not be an attractive model. You know, it's kind of transparent. That's what we want to do. It basically forced the Soviet Union to subsidize Cuba because the hostility of the United States had made it so difficult for the Cuban economy. The same thing happened in Nicaragua. The whole point of the Contras was not really to overthrow Nicaragua, but to make it increasingly difficult for the Nicaraguan regime to constitute itself as an attractive alternative model. The initial Sandinista revolution in Nicaragua, having learned from much of the 20th century, was initially determined to have a deepened democratic form. They wanted it not to be a phony democracy. They wanted it to be a participatory, deep, engaged democracy, and were immediately confronted with the counter-revolutionary war funded by the United States, which then distorted all sorts of priorities and forced all sorts of adaptations internally, which made it, again, a less attractive model. Well, be that as it may, my point here is not the historical point about what happened to the attempt at building whole large-scale society-wide alternatives, but just the key importance of alternative, building alternatives as a way of battling ideologies. And it's why I think things like participatory budgeting, worker co-ops, even Wikipedia, all of these efforts at creating new ways of engaging in social cooperation to satisfy needs and create public goods, why they're all important and why they need to be foregrounded. So even if you're a kind of more traditional and orthodox radical revolutionary socialist, I think bringing these alternatives to the fore in your representation of what the ideals are is crucial, because it's what makes the notion that another world is possible have at least some greater credibility for people. And that's part of the demystification process. Functionalism, back to functionalism. We've had many forays into the problem of functionalism. there's a strong tendency in Marxist discussions of mystification to also treat mystification as in a functionalist way. So the functionalist version of mystification is not just that mystification is a distortion of reality that actually masks the reality, but that this masking always contributes in some optimal way to the reproduction of capitalism. So capitalism produces the necessary distortions for its own reproduction. Right? I mean, in the celestial case, it would be as if there was some, well, there's no point in me telling a fantasy story about making the earth appear to, the sun appear to set, because this was the necessary condition for the reproduction of Catholicism. You know, I mean, capitalism is seen as somehow secreting spontaneously precisely those distortions which are optimal for the reproduction of its own relations. So we've already talked a lot about the problem of functionalism and why there's still a functionalist aspect that should be retained in theory, but the full-blown functionalist explanations are pretty dubious. I'd like to add a couple of extra points with respect to the mystification problem on this. First, mystification distorts the perceptions and understandings of the bourgeoisie as well as the proletariat, to use kind of classical language. Ideology prevents capitalists and the state from understanding the workings of capitalism, not just workers. Now, this may be more damaging to oppositional forces because it may be more crucial to understand how capitalism works if you want to transform it, because you have to mobilize collective action to engage in various transformative activities. So it may be that the muddling through with a contradictory and harmful system is facilitated by everybody being confused about how it works. That may, you know, I think there's some argument that can be made that the mystifications of capitalism harm critiques more than it does supporters. But it's also the case that the mystification of how capitalism works causes great damage in efforts to make capitalism function well. I think that's what we're observing today, that the ideological barriers to understanding the nature of contemporary capitalism and the need for strong public goods to provide the conditions for vibrant accumulation, the ideological barriers to capitalist forces understanding what's in their own interests, is a major problem that that American and global capitalism faces. Capitalist elites are not acting in ways that I think are consistent with the long-run vitality of capitalism. So we have a very suboptimal functioning at the moment. Now, it may be that on balance this still is consistent with a reproduction of capitalism. I think in the muddle through with an imperfect and suboptimal system, that's probably true. But it is not the case that the forms of mystification that we observe in the ideologies of the Tea Party, for example, the way in which they stand by these completely ridiculous claims about how capitalism works, that this is actually optimal for capitalism. It's suboptimal for capitalism, but it may be good enough. Capitalism doesn't need optimal policies, it just needs minimally acceptable ones. And maybe, you know, I think that's probably true. That's very different from saying, yes, this is the functionally optimal solution to have these kinds of ideas be the dominant ones. So the one, I think it's just important to understand, mystifications affect everybody, and they distort the perspectives of elites as well as masses. It's not that the elites have a true understanding and just let these mystifications go and block demystification in order to confuse the masses. They act stupidly as well by virtue of having such distorted views as to how capitalism functions. All of this then, I think, brings to the fore what I see as the central analytical problem, is to understand the obstacles to demystification. That's really where the functionality issue comes into play. It's not that the mystifications are function. It's that blocking demystification is functional. That is, it's functional for capitalism to obstruct the demystification of capitalism. Demystification is a threat. Demystification would create potentially very broad coalitions for a transformation of the balance of class forces and the institutional configurations within which capitalism functions. So blocking demystification is functional. That's not the same as saying that the mystifications themselves are optimal. And it then directs our research attention to precisely that problem. How do we explain the robustness of the ideological apparatuses and mechanisms that block the process of demystification? And this directly takes us to the problem of ideological apparatuses and the problem of struggle. So just as the Catholic Church and its ideological investment in a particular cosmology is crucial to understanding the obstacles to demystification of medieval ideologies of nature, and why a scientific understanding and scientific skepticism about beliefs, that is, scientific beliefs about beliefs, was blocked. The Catholic Church in the early modern period was very worried about people having beliefs about beliefs in which the meta-beliefs were constantly interrogating beliefs. That kind of interior reflexivity about beliefs, which is at the core of what a scientific or enlightenment view about belief formation is, was seen, I think correctly, as a threat to theocratic domination of the sort that was an important part of medieval and then early modern, and was contested in the early modern period. Well, I think the same issue is true with ideological apparatuses today. It's no longer mainly churches, it's other kinds of apparatuses. And ideological struggle then should be understood as struggle over these apparatuses and not just struggle over ideas per se. Ideological struggle is struggle over the control of different kinds of apparatuses, the creation of spaces within which demystification can have free reign, spaces in which alternative perspectives contest freely. In these terms, universities, I think, have a special place. It's no accident that whenever there are military coups and sort of right-wing forces take over, that take Chile in 1973, that one of the first things that happened is that universities are purged. The universities operate under a structure of norms and institutional commitments that allow for a pretty broad space for ideological contestation and for this cultivation of skepticism around the and denaturalization of social relations. When right-wing powers take over, they close down oppositional newspapers and radio stations, of course. Those are the direct apparatuses of of demystification. But they attack universities. So universities, I think, are really crucial sites for this kind of issue. By no means, the only one, but they are really crucial sites for it. The current trends in the development of university institutions oppose new challenges for maintaining it as a space of demystification. Not so much the older challenges. The older challenge was simply the kind of ideological force of the state wanting to clamp down on dissident views in universities. That's not really what's in play in the present period. Very few faculty have been fired in the US for criticizing neoliberalism, for example. The bigger challenge, I think, is the deep interpenetration of capitalist institutions with universities, the commercialization and commodification of university institutions, these public-private partnerships, which have the particular form of the corporatization of universities, which then has the effect of changing the value structure within universities, the incentive structures for what kinds of ideas are worth talking about. So that if in sociology it becomes the case that the only ideas that are worth talking about are the ones that are commercially applicable, it's not so likely in sociology, I think, but there's tendencies in that way. This is very corrosive of creating a space within which challenges to to mystification are at the very center of what a serious academic and intellectual life is all about. Universities then are ideological apparatuses in this sense, even if they're also sites of scientific knowledge production. Again, making that distinction between knowledge production and knowledge inculcation, or knowledge, the way knowledge gets turned into beliefs. Universities are sites of both the production through scientific practices of new knowledge and the formation of ideology. And I think a crucial terrain for these battles in the future. Finally, as a closing comment, in Cohen's argument, he makes an argument I'm pretty dubious about. He says, he argues that fetishism disappears in communism, you know, in this kind of utopian vision of communism, and more generally that communism would be an unmystified social structure. He even goes so far as to say social science would be unnecessary in a communist society because all relations and processes would be transparent. So you only need science when you need something to transform distorted lived experience into cognitively adequate understandings of things. Right? So if everything is transparent and there's no distortions, you don't need science. It no longer has a role to play. And Cohen suggests, glibly, in my judgment, uncharacteristically, although he may be accurately mapping what Marx thought, after all the book is meant to be a reconstruction of Marx's own views, that social life becomes completely transparent in a communist society as defined in its classical terms. Communism as a classless society with fully cooperative and fully consciously cooperative human agents. Social science withers away with communism just like the state withers away. And indeed, they're almost parallel ideas. The state withers away because there's no longer any need for coercion to reproduce social relationships. And the same reasoning basically for why you no longer need authoritative coordination of a state-like character also suggests you no longer need specialized knowledge production around social relations. I think that's just wildly implausible. Both because I don't think class is the only source of confusion and distortion in the social relations that human beings live under. There's massive problems of the relationship between our micro-lived experiences and the macro-integration of these, of social life on larger scales, which can never be transparent because of complexity. Prisoners' dilemmas will always be a problem, even in a world of equals. And prisoners' dilemmas will not be transparently obvious to the actors, because transparently obvious to the actors are what's happening in their own micro settings where they face choices and consequences. So it just seems to me wildly implausible that even if class is no longer a source of distortion, that there'll be other sources of distortion in human communities. And this is especially the case because there are other kinds of social relations besides class relations that also produce asymmetries, gender, ethnicity, nationality, geography, you know, the geographical unevenness of different places. So I think Cohen's facile arguments about the withering away of social science, I don't know, was that in the section that I assigned? I don't remember offhand if... It's in his discussion of fetishism and mystification. In any case, I don't think it should be taken seriously. We won't be out of a job, so to speak, once we have a classless society. Okay.